We introduced them last class, and we discussed some examples of how these could be applied to particular problems. What we'll do today is to begin going through some of the mathematics behind these models and to try to talk about the significance of that. And then depending on how far we get, we may end up talking a little bit about dynamic programming. So thus far, we have dealt with parameter estimation for the static classification problem, estimating the parameters of class conditional densities needed to make a single decision. So what I often call the static classification problem is you have a set of vectors that are fixed length, and you're trying to learn some classes associated with these vectors, and then try to assign each new vector to one of the classes that you've defined based on these existing training vectors. And that's a nice, simple formulation for the pattern classification problem, but that's not typically how problems come to you in the real world, because one of the first things you have to face is segmentation of the data. You don't often know where your data begins and ends within the data stream. So many problems have an inherent temporal dimension. The vectors of interest come from a time series that unfolds as a function of time. Modeling temporal relationships between these vectors is an important part of the problem. Markov models are a popular way to model such signals. There are many generalizations of these approaches, including things like Markov random fields and Bayesian networks. But hidden Markov models are probably the most widely used and have been very successful. First-order Markov processes are very effective because they are sufficiently powerful and computationally efficient. Higher-order Markov processes can be represented using first-order processes. So very often when you see hidden Markov models introduced, you'll see them introduced using a first-order Markovian assumption or first-order framework. And that's been very successful. And that framework can be applied in many ways to sort of model higher-order processes. So there's no real loss of generality in using a first-order model. Markov models are very attractive because of their ability to automatically learn underlying structure. We talked about that last class with the EM algorithm, with the introduction of these hidden variables. One of the nice things about these approaches is that these models, when trained with EM, are capable of learning underlying structure of the data, and often this structure has relevance to the pattern recognition problem. For example, the states might represent physical attributes of the system that generated the data. So we'll see a little bit more of that a little bit later today. We won't see more of that today. There we go. So we'll begin today by talking about discrete hidden Markov models because they're a little easier to discuss and to analyze, and then we'll generalize those to what are called continuous distribution hidden Markov models. So to the right here, I have a picture of a state machine that consists of three states, omega 1, omega 2, and omega 3. And we have connections between those three states. Any state can transition to any other state. We can go from omega 1 to itself. That's often called a self-transition. We can go from omega 1 to omega 2, from omega 2 back to omega 1, and so forth. Every time you enter a state, you output one symbol, V1, and we're going to call those symbols Vs. So you output either V1, V2, V3, V4. And in this very simple formulation, every output symbol is possible at every state. That's, again, just a simplification, but doesn't really restrict us in practice. So what are the elements of the model? Well, the first obvious element are the number of states, which we will denote by the variable C. And the vector omega superscript C, we're going to denote as a vector of states, omega 1 through omega C. That's just the indices of the states. The next thing we need to think about are these output symbols. If, for example, we were using this technology to model a coin toss experiment, what would our output symbols be? Heads or tails. So the output symbols are the observables, and those will typically relate to a particular problem that you're trying to solve, like the coin toss problem or the colored balls drawn from an urn or any of those kinds of things. So we'll let those symbols be denoted as V1 through V sub M. There will be a total of M of those symbols. Again, all symbols will be possible at all states, which is going to create an interesting element of ambiguity in the model, which we'll discuss shortly. Now, the next thing we need to think about with this model are these transitions. We'd like to model those as transition probabilities. So we will define a C by C transition probability matrix, A11, A12, all the way out to A1C, and then so forth. And each one of these elements will denote a particular transition, A11, A12, and so forth. And these probabilities within this transition matrix can be written as the probability of being in state omega sub I at time t and transitioning to state omega sub j at time t plus 1. So those transition probabilities are going to denote the probability of omega sub j at time t plus 1 given omega sub I at time t. So Aij means we're in state I and we transition to state j. So now note that the transition probabilities only depend on the previous state and the current state. Previous state and the current state. Hence, this is a first-order Markov process. If these transition probabilities depended on omega sub I minus 1, omega sub I minus 2, and so forth, omega sub I at t, omega sub m at t minus 1, t minus 2, and so forth, it would be a higher order Markov process. And people have tried to build those and gotten, marginal benefit from that. And there are other ways to encode that kind of information in certain problems. So primarily people have been using this kind of a model within Markov models. The next thing that we need to think about are the probabilities that we output one of these symbols at each of these states. So that's a very important aspect of this model, the fact that at state omega sub 1, we can output V sub 2, and at state omega sub 3, we can output V sub 2, and those probabilities can be different. And they should be different, because we want these states to represent different aspects of the system. So this gives us an output probability matrix, which we typically call B, B11 through B1M along the first row, and then down the columns, B11 through BT1. And what this represents, Bij, represents the probability that we output symbol V sub J at time T, given we were in state J at time t. And that's wrong. This should be omega sub I. So Bij is essentially when you're in state I and you output symbol J. I'll fix that after class. Now, the last piece of information that we need about the model is the probability of starting in a particular state. And we denote that as pi of 0, and that simply represents a set of C probabilities that represents the probability of being in a particular state at time zero. So these are essentially what we call our initial state probabilities. And they actually play an important role in the model itself. So we'll see more of that in a moment. So the model itself is pretty compact. We essentially have a transition probability matrix, an output probability matrix, and these initial probabilities. And then some sort of implied variables, the number of states and the output alphabet. Now, there are some important properties or consequences of these definitions. And one is that the state and output probability distributions must sum to one, which means that the sum over J of Aij, which is essentially you're at state I and you want to transition, you have to transition to some other state with probability 1. So when you're at state I, you have to go somewhere. And therefore, the sum of A sub ij with respect to J is equal to 1. And then similarly, when you're at state I and you output symbol J, the sum from J equals 1 to M of B sub ij is equal to 1, which simply means when you're at a state, you have to output some symbol with some probability. So there you've got a probability distribution that describes that, and that all and that sums to 1. A Markov model is called ergodic if every one of the states has a non-zero probability of occurring given some starting state. So the model that we drew on the previous page . This is a fully ergodic model because all states can transition to all other states. Now that's a nice, interesting construct, but it turns out in many, many application spaces we don't actually use a model like that. We use a model that's more restrictive because we want the model to reflect certain constraints that we know about the problem. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, probably tomorrow, next class. A Markov model is called a hidden Markov model, or HMM, if the output symbols cannot be observed directly, meaning that they correspond to a state and can only be observed through a second stochastic process. HMMs are often referred to as a doubly stochastic system or model because the state transitions and outputs are modeled as stochastic processes. Okay, so that's a mouthful, but let's think about that in context of our discussion yesterday and the model that we're showing here. So we'll go through some examples of this shortly, but let's assume for the moment that that these output symbols correspond to heads and tails. If I give you a sequence, a head followed by a tail, you don't really know which one of these states produced that sequence because those symbols are possible at all the states. Now, initially, you might think, well, that doesn't make sense. It would be better to let one state correspond to H and one state correspond to tails. And that's what we call a observable model. That is not a hidden Markov model because the states actually correspond to the output symbols. And you can build models like that, but in the long run, when dealing with real problems, you'll find models like that do not do as well as these hidden models where the system's allowed to self-organize the information and come up with a better model. And in fact, if you train a hidden model and sort of compare it to a equivalent a fully observable model on a set of data, generally speaking, the hidden model will give you a better model because it has more degrees of freedom. But the price you pay for that is you don't really know what exactly went on in this model when it produced the sequence heads-tails. You can only guess. And that's where EM comes in. We will train the model to become very good at making those guesses or inferences, but we don't really know for sure that that's what happened. So what this statement reflects is that with a hidden model, you never really know what the underlying state sequence was. All you know is with some probability a particular output sequence was produced. Now further, if you look at that model that we had on the previous page, the sequence heads-tails could be produced any number of ways. 1 to 2, 1 to 1, 1 to 3, 2, and so forth. So in fact, we will see shortly that to deal with that, we actually compute the probability by summing up all possible ways that sequence could have been produced. So we never really know exactly what happened. We can only infer that because we're distant from that by a second stochastic system. So we have a stochastic system in terms of state transitions, and then we have a stochastic system in terms of output probabilities. And what we will learn to do with HMMs are to train these probabilities on data so that we can allow the model to model the data as best as it can. So when we want to begin analyzing the properties of hidden Markov models, there's three fundamental problems that we encounter. The first one is evaluation. How do we efficiently compute the probability that a particular sequence of states was produced? The second is decoding. What is the most likely sequence of hidden states that produced an observed sequence? And these two together essentially form what we call the recognition problem, that we have to have a way of computing the probability that a particular sequence could have been observed. That's the evaluation part. We have to have we have to be able to take a sequence and classify it or decode it using this model. And then the third problem is parameter estimation, learning. How do we estimate the parameters of the model? And the third part is where we will use the EM theorem. So let's begin sort of chipping away at these one by one. So we'll first look at evaluation. The probability of being in... So hidden Markov models are really interesting because they're very simple. The probability of being in any state at any time is easily computed. It's simply the product of these eight transition matrices times the initial state probability vector. So let's think about that. If you start in pi, the vector pi describes the probability of being in a state at time zero. So if I ask you, what is the probability that you were in state 1 at time 0, you would just return to me pi of 1, if 1 corresponded to state 1, and pi of 2, pi of 3, and so forth. Now we advance the clock by one tick, t is equal to 1. The probability of being in state 1... Well, what is that going to be? Well, how could we get to state 1 from state... How could we get to state 1, essentially? Well, any of the states in a fully ergodic model, any of the states... We could have been in any of the states at time 0, and then we would have had to transition to state 1 at time 1. So if you think about that long enough, you say, well, that's simply going to be the probability of being in state 1 at time 0... times the probability of transitioning from state 1 to state 1. That's one way I could have gotten to 1. But I could have also gotten to 1 by being in state 2 at time 0 and transitioning to state 1 at time 1, and so forth. So if you write those equations out and you look at them long enough, you say, aha, that's just going to be A, the matrix A, times pi. Now, the neat thing about the model, since it's a discrete model, when you ask, well, what's going to happen at time two? Well, you're just going to repeat that process. You're going to take all the results you have for time one and multiply them once again by A. So the probability of being in any state at any time can be computed. You essentially compute this A to the power T times pi, and that gives you all of these probabilities, and then you just, if you want to know a particular state, you can just look up the particular state. But this calculation is very revealing because it first of all tells us that we can compute all states for all times simultaneously. Or stated another way, there's no, to get the information about any one state, we kind of have to do all the work for all the states. Because you can get to any state from any other state. But it also shows us that the calculation is somewhat iterative in nature. The next time instance is a function of the previous time instance. So we can write a recursion for this. And we'll show how to do that in a moment. Now, when Markov models were first introduced, people were excited because they said, oh, look at that, a very simple equation. But these computations have a very significant computational complexity. The overall computation, because we have a matrix raised to the t power, and that matrix is of dimension c by c, we have a computation which is the constant c raised to the t power times t, where t is the length of the sequence. So it's linear, you could say it's sort of linear in time, except that we've got this c to the power t. So it's actually exponential with respect to t. And these computations are prohibitive for even the simplest of models. So if you look at, for example, 10 states over 20 time intervals, you have 10 to the 21st calculations just to get that probability. And even today, this is for complex models where you have thousands of states, this computation is beyond the capabilities of modern-day computers. And that, therefore, without some kind of computational complexity reduction, the models themselves would be useless to us. And therefore, it took people a number of years to come up with these reductions. But by the mid-70s or so, these were recursive approaches to these solutions were well known. So we will look at ways to significantly reduce the computational complexity here. And I think that's one of the really interesting things about hidden Markov models is we go from a prohibitive number of calculations to very efficient ways to get these calculations. We save orders and orders of magnitude. I mean, or it's like exponentially orders of magnitude. We go from things being, 10 to the power 100 to things being 10 to the power 1, 10 to the power 2, very, very sort of compact. So there's enormous savings in the computations doing this, and that's really what has enabled these to be used in real systems. So how can we restructure this calculation? Well, we can calculate this recursively by exploiting the first order property of the process and noting that the probability of being at state time t is easily computed by summing all possible paths from the previous state. So what it becomes convenient to do is to lay out these indices aren't showing up very well, but to basically lay out the states here, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth, as a function of time. And this is what we call a trellis or a lattice. Some people call it a lattice, but it's essentially just taking our three states and describing them in a lattice where these three circles represent those states at time 0 and time 1, time 2, and so forth. And then we can actually restructure this calculation so that the calculation at any point here is just the sum of what we've That's interesting. Just the sum of what we accumulated at this point. So we can essentially do a recursive computation for this. And that's nice because that says that the computation for the next time instance is really very small. It's just a matter of accumulating weights from accumulating scores from the three previous states. So per unit time, using this recursive approach, the computations are actually fairly small. Now, there's one, we've talked thus far about the probability of being in a state at any time, and that's sort of half of the picture. We then want to know what is the probability of outputting a particular sequence, a particular symbol at that state at that time. So in addition to so if this is the probability of being in a state at a particular time, if we multiply this by the matrix B, we actually then get the probability of being, of outputting a particular symbol at that state at that time. Because once you're in the state, then all you have to do is multiply the probability of being in that state by the probability of outputting each one of the symbols. And then if you do that for each one of the states, you essentially get because remember that the probability of outputting, for example, a head could have occurred here, 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 or here at time two or time three. So we have to sum up the probabilities from each one of those states. So essentially we can do all this in one shot by calculating this a to the power t times pi and then multiplying that by b. And that then sums the probability of outputting heads, for example, from each one of these states. And then similarly the probability for tails summed across each one of those states. So problem of computing output probability distribution is, or output probabilities is pretty simple. Once we have this a to the power t times pi, we just have to multiply by b, and then we can get the probability of outputting any symbol at any time. And implied in that is that probability summed across all the internal states. So, looking at that trellis or that grid, that lattice, we've essentially derived or defined what's called the forward algorithm, and this is the probability. This is what we use to compute the probability of being in a state at time t, and we're going to denote that by alpha sub j of t, where t represents time, and j represents the jth state, and we can do that through a recursion. Where we can do that through recursion, where at t is equal to zero, if j is not the initial state, the probability is zero. If j is the initial state, the probability is one. And then subsequently, we're just going to take the sum of all previous states times the transition probability. So we have the sum over the sum of alpha sub I t minus 1 times aij. Let me show you that on the trellis. So that's just describing this computation here, where to get from here, we have to take a sub 1, 2 times alpha sub 1 of 2 and so forth. So we just have to take the accumulated probabilities here, weight them by the transition probabilities to get here and sum those up. And then if we want to get the output probability associated with that, we also have to multiply by bjk times b of t. And this bjk times b of t denotes essentially the symbols bjk was emitted at time t. So this this alpha, I need, this is actually not quite right here. This alpha is the probability of being in state J at time t. And then when you add the BJK, this adds the probability of outputting the K symbol at the J state at time t. And so we can write this as a very simple recursion. And this is what's known as the forward algorithm. And it's one of the things that we'll use to manipulate hidden Markov models. Now, the forward algorithm still has a significant computational complexity associated with it, because we're recursing over every state for all of time. So its computational complexity is better than what we had for the matrix raised to the t power times pi, but it's still significant. So we get 17 orders of magnitude reduction over the matrix form, A to the transpose pi, using the forward algorithm. But we still get something which is proportional to c squared times t. And that's not bad. We can live with that. But we actually, in a moment, we'll show you even faster way to approximate that calculation. But before we do that, we're going to need a time-reversed version of this algorithm, which computes probabilities backwards in time. This is sort of a nice property of probabilities that, or really any kind of multiplication and accumulation, is we can do the accumulation forward in time, or if all of time is known, we can do the accumulation backwards in time also. Now, when would you have a reason to use that? Well, during training. You have this utterance or this data set, and you want to compute probabilities. You can compute that in the forward direction, or you can compute that in the backward direction. It doesn't really matter, because you have all of the data. You're essentially have collected all the data for time. But it turns out that process of going forward and backward is integral to how we train the parameters. So we'll actually use this during the training process. But for now, just think about it as, you know, if you're going to multiply 1 times 2 times 3, you could just as easily multiply 3 times 2 times 1. So we have a backward algorithm which starts at time t and works backwards to give you things at time 0. And that's what we call the betas. And we can write a similar recursion that beta sub I of t is just beta sub j of t plus 1 summed over j times aij times bjk. Now, the interesting consequence of this is that the probability of being in any state at any time can be calculated as a product of alpha for the path from 0 to t and beta for the path from t plus 1 to t. So just to sort of make this even a little more obscure, we can actually compute this overall probability as the product of an alpha term plus times a beta term. And that's something that we'll actually make use of during training. So we'll just note that for the moment. Now, welcome to the world where MATLAB fails. Actually not, but I think MATLAB has some functions for this now that do these calculations. But I always enjoy when students who've not really spent a lot of time working with fixed point arithmetic sit down on a computer and don't think twice about multiplying 2 billion numbers together, each of which is less than one. So what do we know about probabilities? What about the scale of probabilities? They're between 0 and 1, right? So what happens as you multiply probabilities together? I don't care what they are, whether your model is good, whether your model is bad. There's one thing I can guarantee will happen. It's going to get closer and closer to 0. Now, this has a really interesting consequence, and since it's Friday, I guess we used to have Philosophical Friday in my group. On Fridays, I can always be a little philosophical. So, and I think this is actually an example of where probabilities may not really fit many of the things we observe in modern world. If you accumulate every word I have said thus far in this course, starting from day one, what is the probability of that overall sequence of words? By now, it's pretty much zero, right? And for the rest of the semester, it's going to be even more zero, closer to zero. In fact, the probability of just about any sentence you speak, other than maybe or I know, or yeah, the probability of just about any sentence you speak is essentially zero. Because there's so many possible sentences. There's an infinite number of sentences, actually. And the probability of that sentence is sort of the product of the probabilities of the individual words. So these things all go down to zero very, very quickly. How is that a problem with the forward algorithm? Or why is that a problem with the forward algorithm? You're continuing to multiply and accumulate numbers which are essentially between 0 and 1. So with every one of these multiplies you do, the overall value gets smaller. Smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, in the world of theoretical math, that's not a problem. But I can tell you that in the world of signal processing, that's a big problem. Because eventually, even for the simplest of hidden Markov models, the computational noise associated with that computation swamps the actual numbers you're trying to compute, and you get nothing but garbage out of these models. And that is actually a very real computational issue. So what we tend to do what we have to do with these models are we do two things. We first normalize the calculation by essentially at each point in time, we divide by this scale factor Q, where Q is the essentially scaling by the sum of all the alphas at that corresponding time. So we essentially maintain a normalization factor that allows us to weight all of the alphas by a fixed constant, but that constant has to grow as a function of time because the alphas are decreasing as a function of time. So we compute this, we use this scale factor, and by doing that then we can sort of guarantee that as these alphas, as alpha primes as a function of time, will stay in about the same range. They won't have this property of just kind of going off to zero as time goes on. So this normalization is applied once per state per unit time, and it simply involves scaling the alphas by their sum at each epoch. So that's one thing that we do. Second thing that we do, we note that likelihoods tend to zero as time increases and cause underflow. Therefore, it is more common to operate on log probabilities to maintain numerical precision. This converts products to sums, which is a good thing, but it still involves essentially the same algorithm. Though when we have, if you remember in the alpha equation, we had a summation. This has a problem, though. If we want to take the log of a sum, that doesn't decompose as easily. The log of a product is just the sum of the logs. The log of a sum is not really well defined. So we actually, but since we know that the terms we're summing are less than one, we actually use an approximation for the logarithm of the sum so that we can apply logarithms throughout. So all these computations must be done in a log space to avoid numerical underflow. And that's actually a very important practical detail that, I've not run HMMs in MATLAB. I don't know, but I imagine there's toolboxes in MATLAB that do this kind of normalization. But, in the early days, this is why we programmed these things in languages like C or C++, where we had to pay attention to these kinds of details. So now we might ask, well, how can we do classification using HMMs? Well, we can actually very nicely integrate these into a Bayesian framework. If we concatenate our HMM parameters into a single vector, which we will call theta, we can write Bayes' formula as the probability of theta given a set of observed symbols V sub t, and we can write that as the probability of V raised to the t power times theta times p of theta over p of p of v superscript t. So this is saying that this is essentially using Bayes' formula as we've used it before to relate these posteriors to the priors and the evidence. We typically ignore the denominator term during maximization because if we want to classify an incoming piece of data, that term's going to be the same for all classes, so we don't have to include that in the maximization. In some applications, like speech processing, we use domain knowledge to compute P of theta, and in speech recognition, this is often what we call the language model, and I think we mentioned that earlier in the course. It's also possible to use HMM to model this prior, and in fact, we do that in statistical language modeling. So we not only have an HMM for this term, but we also have an HMM for this term. But in a typical classification application, there are a set of HMMs, one for each category, so you will essentially compute this term for each one of your models, and then you'll choose the maximum. So you'll do this computation per model. So it's possible to train, essentially you'll train multiple models for your system. The models, for example, could represent the words you're trying to recognize. And then if you were working in an isolated word recognition case, you have an incoming piece of data, and you want to essentially ask the question, well, what word was spoken? Well, what you would do is you would compute this, you do essentially the forward algorithm for each one of your models representing each possible word that could be spoken, and then you choose the word that was most probable. Now, that's sort of the simplest of cases. The models themselves would represent those state machines we showed, but the hidden states within those models might be something like phonemes, or might be just something like acoustic segments. So it's common when you're using hidden Markov models to actually build your overall probability as a hierarchy of these models. You may have a language model which describes sentences in terms of words. You may have a word model which describes words in terms of phonemes. You may have a phoneme model which describes phonemes in terms of states or acoustic events. And then you have those acoustic events are your actual place where you somehow compute the probability of feature vectors and things. However, in most problems that we apply HMMs, you don't really know. You don't often know where the data begins or ends. You actually have a sequence of events. For example, with word recognition, we might consider a problem like digit recognition, where I can speak any one of the 10 or 11 digits. So I can say 1, 2, 3, 4, 0, and you want to build a machine that can recognize that sequence using models for each one of the words individually. So to do that recognition, you're going to need to do some kind of search where you search for the most probable combination of models. Similarly, we talked about within a model, you don't know which state sequence produced the actual output. So you might ask yourself, well, the probability that this model produced this data, I could compute that using the forward algorithm and sum up all possible ways the data could have been computed. But then I don't know which set of states was the most likely set of states to produce that data. And that might be useful to me. So what might the most probable sequence of hidden states that produced an observed sequence be? Why might the most probable sequence of hidden states that produced an observed sequence be useful to us? So why might it be useful to know, when I speak a word, what sequence of states in my model actually produced that word? Or why might it be useful to know, if you're analyzing coin tosses, which of your internal states produce the overall most probable hypothesis for the data? And this kind of inference, if you think about it, leads you to wanting to perhaps have a way to decide what was the most probable sequence of states that could have produced that data. The data could have been produced by any number of states. You don't really know, but you would like to know sometimes what's the most probable sequence of states that could have produced that. Just one sequence, not every possible sequence. So the question then is, how do we find the most probable sequence of hidden states? And the answer to that is something known as the Turvey decoding or dynamic programming. So since any symbol is possible at any state, the obvious approach would be to compute the probability of each path and to choose the most probable. And we can write that mathematically as an argmax operation by simply computing all possible paths and then retaining the probability and the index sequence for the most probable path. Now, what's the problem with that? If I have a fully ergodic model and it has, let's say, 100 states associated with it, because there's 100, if the sequence is 10, is if I have 100 states and the sequence is 10 time instances long, I have something like 100 to the 10th power possible sequences that could have produced that data. However, there's an alternate solution to this problem, which is provided by dynamic programming and is known as the Turvey decoding. And the algorithm for Viterbi decoding is shown here. Now, I'm going to explain this in more detail in a moment. But it essentially uses it's a computationally efficient way to get the optimal solution. You get the right path, the right score, but it gives you that solution much more efficiently. Now, if you use the Viterbi algorithm to find the overall probability of a path through the model, you find the best path through the model, that score, that probability that you get, will be different. It will be smaller, actually, than the forward algorithm because you haven't added up all possible ways that sequence could be produced. You're only getting the single most possible, most probable sequence. So the Viterbi algorithm gives us something different than the forward algorithm, but it's a useful result because it allows us to associate the most probable state sequence with a particular observation sequence. Now, what I'll do next time, last time I, actually every time I've taught the course, students have not been that familiar with dynamic programming. And I don't quite understand that because it's taught in some of the CS courses, but not all our students here have background in that. So what I'll do next time, what happened, I developed a small number of slides to just go through some of the basics of dynamic programming. Because actually, historically, before we had hidden Markov models, we used dynamic programming to do pattern recognition. And it's a really kind of interesting algorithm. It can be used in many different ways for pattern recognition applications. So I think it's worth it to spend, we'll spend about half a lecture on it. But normally this is something that's covered in like the intro to algorithms class, if you have a chance to take that. So we'll stop here for today, and we'll pick this up on Monday.